From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm your host, Elisa Orlando, for today, with our thanks to Matthew Leonard and Evan Dawson for Innovation Friday. We now switch gears with an edition of Second Opinion Live. Beginning Monday night, the three-part Ken Burns film, Cancer, The Emperor of All Maladies, which is based on the book of the same name, starts airing on PBS stations across the country, including here on WXXI. In many cases, this diagnosis, the diagnosis of cancer, is no longer something that's secret. And it's often a diagnosis that's treatable. Progress in cancer care has been made in every area: prevention, screening, targeted therapy, chemotherapy, surgery, radiation, supportive care. All of these areas have seen progress over the last 20 years. In fact, since 1971, according to the National Cancer Institute's most recent survey from 2006, for cancers diagnosed in 2006, 68.4% of people survived the cancer for at least 5 years. Yet every year, 12.7 million people receive a cancer diagnosis. Now, for the patient, a diagnosis means action, treatments to be decided on, family members to tell, doctors, treatment appointments, procedures, surgeries, and lifestyle changes. And today, we're going to talk mostly about what happens when a person is declared cancer-free, when some of that action, at least, is more or less over. So joining me in studio today to share their story are Tiffany and Rick Staropoli. Tiffany's been in remission for 1 year, and Rick is more than 5 years out from his cancer diagnosis. And in studio, we have Dr. Louis Constein, professor of radiation oncology and pediatrics, and the director of the Judy DiMarzo Cancer Center Survivorship Program at the James P. Wilmot Cancer Center. Dr. Constein is also the vice chair of the Department of Radiation Oncology at URMC. Now, you can watch this program on the web at secondopinion-tv.org. That's probably, if you can see it, that's probably where you're watching it right now. You can also participate in today's conversation by calling us at 844-295-TALK, 295-8255, or you can tweet your questions to the hashtag 2NDOP. Just use that hashtag when you tweet. I can see it on my phone, and we'll pick up the question, and Dr. Constein or Tiffany and Rick will answer your question or respond to your comment. A special thanks just now to the sponsor of Second Opinion, the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association. It's through their generous support that we can provide you with timely, accurate, and valuable health information. And thank you to our public radio and television supporters who make shows like this possible. So let's get started. We are going to talk about life after cancer, but let's get into the idea of diagnosis to begin with. And Tiffany, I'll start with you. You've been married for a few years in your late 30s doing work you love. Mm-hmm. And then in May of 2013, you had a drastic change in your life with a diagnosis of stage 4 colon cancer. I bet pretty surprising.
Oh, very surprising. Yeah, it was. I was presenting with symptoms of blood in my stool, and it's pretty important to talk about because it's very easily something that you can ignore. And I passed it off myself as, oh, it's probably just hemorrhoids. I need more fiber in my diet. So I let it go for like 2 or 3 months, and until it just kept being persistent and consistent. And I ended up kind of freaking out, going to my doctor. I actually went to see him 1 week and walked out without saying anything because I just didn't want to bring it up. Seemed a little bit embarrassing.
Were you afraid or were you just embarrassed?
Embarrassed.
Okay.
So yeah. Oh, right. No. I, as far as afraid, I just didn't want to have to deal with somebody checking out my rear end. I mean, okay. It really was that basically that. I'm like, oh, I don't want to embarrass him. I don't want to embarrass him, you know. And a week later, I just kind of freaked. I mean, I can't let this go. I need to find out what's going on. And thank God I did. I went back and he did the right tests and he recommended a colonoscopy. And again, going there, I'm 38 years old. You know, I don't expect anything more. He didn't say any word of like possible cancers. I mean, he maybe had mentioned a possible polyp. I didn't even know what that was. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I go in for the colonoscopy, and yeah, you get the doctor as you're coming out of, you know, your like drug induced stupor. He tells me I have they found a cancerous mass, and you just like you're grappling with how is that even possible. I mean, right. You know, so it was quite shocking.
Especially for a young woman. I mean, young women do get colon cancer. Annually, I think the statistic is 26,000 women die from it. But for some reason, we don't think of it as a disease that a woman gets. Probably it's more prevalent in men. 140,000 people are diagnosed with colon cancer in the United States every year. And stage 4 treatment, when you got into that discussion, and when I assume that what I just said is partially based on understanding your situation, which is that you spring into action, right?
Oh,
immediately,
exactly. Yeah.
Immediately, your life changes. Can you describe that?
Yeah, well, we did have, if you want to call it the benefit of having had gone through cancer with my husband, Rick,
right.
Had Hodgkin's lymphoma 5 years prior. So we did, we knew what chemotherapy was all about. We had a cancer center that we trusted. We had an oncologist that we were used to. So we knew exactly who we were going to call. And so we sprang into action there. But this was a very different case. You know, Rick's was stage 2B Hodgkin's lymphoma. Mine was stage 4 colon cancer. Hugely different. You know, and when they told me it was stage 4, meaning it had spread farther than the colon, it had actually spread to my liver. And if you dare make the mistake of Googling statistics of stage 4 colon cancer, I mean, it's grim. So, yeah, you do spring into action and, like, just kind of you're thrown into this world of cancer and let's just get this done. Just tell me what needs to be done and we'll do it.
So what did you do? Can you briefly describe what you did for treatment?
Right. The first thing up is they immediately had me in for surgery within a couple of weeks to have the tumor removed from my colon. And then we did chemotherapy that for a few treatments of chemotherapy, I think five, that was like given to me every other week. I had a little fanny pack I would wear I would go in for an infusion and then walk out with a fanny pack like a little ball that was continually infusing me for 48 hours of chemotherapy. And I did that for five treatments. Then I went in for that allowed the tumor in the liver to shrink a bit and allowed them to then resect the liver, which go in, remove the tumor in the liver. And then I ended with additional chemotherapy to make sure that any kind of little particles of of cancer floating around in my body might be eradicated at that point.
All right. So speaking of life after cancer, Rick, you had been through some of this, something similar, let's say, and now you're in the role of caregiver. Can you describe what that was like for me, for you?
Yeah, it was much, much harder than being the patient, that's for sure. Yeah, I was my experience with cancer was, as Tiffany said, very different. It was much simpler. When it came time to having a loved one, the person I'm living with, the person who's the partner of my life, go through it, I was pretty freaked out. And I saw it as a serious responsibility on my part to lighten the load for her, to somehow make it so that her life could go on in whatever way she wanted it to during it, or not, that she could completely take a break for however many months she had to and not feel any pressure, you know, keep finances away from her eyes, you know, that sort of thing. Just kind of make it so that all she had to do was care for herself. So it was a strange transition.
And Tiffany, you had been through something like this, although Rick, you describe it as being a little simpler. Did you feel the same way when you were the caregiver? I mean, you've both been patient and caregiver. Rick says it's harder to be a caregiver. What do you think?
I absolutely agree that being, you know, in my experience, being the caregiver is absolutely harder. I actually think my role as a caregiver was so much easier than what he had to go through. His cancer did not involve surgeries, you know, it was not as lengthy as mine. It was fairly straightforward. He was an exceptional caregiver, and it was amazing for me as a patient. You know, like, there's so much community rallies around people going through cancer. It's very easy to, like, you know, to have that support. You find love and support, and people are just like, you know, championing you. That's a word, but I think the caregiver can get lost in that, and they're feeling this pressure of, you know, maintaining the household and, like you said, shielding the patient from any kind of pressures, any kind of anything they have to deal with, so they can do the job of getting well. And I think the caregiver is the most important role.
All right, I want to bring Dr. Constein, Louis Constein, into the conversation because you work with a survivorship program. And given that more and more people are surviving cancer, that sometimes certain kinds of cancers are characterized now more as chronic diseases than death sentences as they used to be, do you expect to see more situations like this where you have two people in a family, or are you seeing more where you have a husband and a wife or more than one person in a family dealing with a diagnosis, supporting each other, and having this kind of a story?
It certainly is remarkable to hear both Tiffany and Rick describe the last years of their life. And I'm just impressed and struck by the intensity that must have accompanied both of your diagnoses mm-hmm. and the treatments you received. As you've now discussed, cancer is a very common, dreadful disease. And at the moment, there are probably about 13 million survivors of cancer in the United States, which is about 4% of the population. It's a moral imperative that physicians caring for patients treated for cancer be aware of the consequences of the cancer on the lives of their patients, and also on the possible consequences of the treatment on their subsequent health. Mm. Our first priority is always to cure the cancer, but beyond that, we must pay attention to the effects of the cancer and its treatment on the quality of life of each patient and maximize that quality of life.
Do you think that's happening? You're calling that a moral imperative.
It is.
And do you think it's happening that doctors are thinking about what will happen after the chemo, or what might the effects be? I know we talk about effects, physical effects, but it seems to me like you're talking about something a little more global than just side effects.
Well, I am. Certainly the side effects of treatment must be understood. We have many responsibilities as caregivers for patients with cancer. We must educate both the patient and their primary physicians about the cancer and about its treatment. We must be in constant communication about the progress the patient is making through that journey. And we must prepare both the patient and their primary caretakers for the possible consequences of treatment. And that's our responsibility as oncologists. So it's something that each of us understands, and we do our best to fulfill that obligation, but certainly it would be variable throughout the country as to how well that responsibility is met.
All right, we're talking about living cancer right now, life after cancer, life with cancer, after cancer. It's kind of hard to find the words to describe mm-hmm. what we really mean by this. There are a lot of different sort of mm-hmm. projects and initiatives and ways to talk about what we mean. Rick, you're how many years out from your treatment since from being cancer-free?
I'm just approaching my six-year mark.
Okay, great. And Tiffany, you are?
A little over a year.
Okay, so mm-hmm. both of you are a little over a year and just approaching the six-year mark in terms of survivorship. There's another chapter to this story, which I'm going to tell next. First, I want to give the telephone number, though. Our phone number is 844-295-TALK. If you'd like to talk to Tiffany Staropoli or Rick Staropoli or Dr. Constein, perhaps you're having a cancer experience in your own family or in your own life, be happy to make comments or answer questions for you. That's 844-295-8255. You can also tweet your questions to the hashtag 2NDOP. That stands for Second Opinion, and we'll take your questions on Twitter as well. Love to hear from you this hour. So the next chapter to this is that Tiffany became a little bit famous as she went through her cancer treatment. I should say a lot famous. You have become sort of a poster child for approaching a cancer diagnosis and treatment plan in a positive way. Your Dancing with Cancer videos went viral on YouTube. And I'd like to have you tell me a little bit about how you came up with that notion, where the dancing came from, and then we'll talk about what's happening with those ideas now.
Sure. Just very shortly after diagnosis, I really wanted to find a way to quickly pull me out of a tailspin if I was going negative. And it was in the first week that I said to Rick, you know, I got to do something. What I need you to do is, you know, when I'm getting morose, I'm gonna dance, and I'm gonna want you to record it with the phone, and that'll help me. And you know, we started doing that and taping, recording me dancing these silly, crazy dances in like all these different places. I was dancing in chemotherapy and right before surgery, and you know, from a wheelchair, and it was a lot of fun, and it really did work. I found that it really, I mean. You know, at one point, the first time we did it, I was on my way to see some family members, you know, and I didn't know how I was going to face them. I was in tears, and Rick was like, well, time to dance. Get out of the car. and he, you know, forced me to get out and dance, and it was awesome. But it was this, it kind of spun into, you know, we made the video, and that got posted, and it was great, and there was a lot of great response to it. But it really was kind of a metaphor for my journey through active cancer, was really this moving and fun, if you want to call it that, and gentle experience. I felt kind of radiated and lifted up by like this incredible tidal wave of love from our community, in a way that I've never felt before. And I felt so like I was just doing exactly what needed to be done. Like I was in the right place, just taking care of myself, and I was taken care of. And it was beautiful. It was moving, you know. So, and as a stark contrast from where I find myself today.
Explain that for me. Let's talk about that now.
So here we are, like very, like shortly after my you know, diagnosis, I'm now told I'm in remission. And everybody who hears that goes, oh my gosh, great, wonderful. She's back. She can just do her thing. And everyone in your community kind of retreats and everything. Life goes back to normal. But your life, my life, will never again be normal. So now I find myself grappling with these, because I don't have the identity of the girl with cancer and my job is not to get well. Well, what is my job then? What is my purpose? Why am I here? I start questioning, you know, am I doing the right thing? Is my job fulfilling me the way I want it to? Am I, if I only have, you know, I've been given this huge chance at life again, I better make the best of it. You know, so that I'm putting this a lot of pressure on myself to do, and it's been this kind of spiral into this darkness that dancing, I just kind of don't want to dance right now.
Yet those videos are going to live forever.
Oh yeah.
Looking back on that now, do you think that was the right decision to take them to the internet?
Oh, sure, absolutely. Because it's lifted up other people and given people a perspective of cancer that they may not have thought of. And it's been very positive and energizing. I absolutely still agree with it. You know, my philosophy of cancer has never been, I don't fight cancer. I talk about, you know, the language of cancer. I don't battle it. I don't fight it. I accept it and I love it. And I treat it with kindness and respect because my body created it, you know. So I don't agree with those battle metaphors. And I think that kind of, you know, I started a blog and started talking about that. And I think that video and that blog has kind of opened people up to these other perceptions of cancer.
All right, Dr. Constein, I'm going to take a crack at the idea that this is not the usual response to a cancer diagnosis that you hear from a patient, and that not everybody is going to say is going to describe it as eloquently as Tiffany just did. What's your take on this in terms of, first of all, how she made her decision to describe it this way, and now what's happening now?
Well, I think each patient's reaction to cancer is remarkably complex, and I wouldn't say that I could typify any individual's response to cancer, because I think for each person, they have their own response. And what I've heard from Tiffany is a joy for having apparently, or at least for some period of time, defeated this cancer, but then an awareness of the fragility of life, the preciousness of life. One doesn't take anything for granted. You know, I'm reminded of a poem I wrote a few years ago. For the person fighting cancer, each day is precious and must be faced with courage. For the physician, each patient is an inspiration. And for the survivor of cancer, the world is full and each day is a celebration. Mm-hmm. That actually describes a lot of complex feelings about cancer and a dependency on where you are in that progression or that journey. Are you fighting the cancer? Are you now considering yourself a survivor of cancer? What are the emotions that you're feeling? Remarkably complicated, but I think all put in perspective by the fact that all of us in this room know that our lifetimes are finite. And when faced with something that threatens our life, hopefully we gain a wisdom and an understanding that we could not otherwise have understood. I think people who have cancer really gain access to a world that's not available to the rest of us. They learn something about the preciousness of life. They learn that they don't want to waste time, as Tiffany has told us. But it's interesting that for Tiffany, that has become very complicated because on the one hand, she doesn't want to waste time. But on the other hand, she doesn't feel the motivation at this moment to do some of the things she most wants to do. And how does she find her way through that conundrum? And that's actually something that all cancer physicians need to be aware of. And that's one of the purposes of our the Wilmot Cancer Institute Survivorship Program. It's to be there for patients. It's to help them come to grips with some of these complicated emotions, and then to provide them with resources, if they want, that would allow them to get help in trying to unravel some of these very complicated problems.
So let's, and I want to ask Rick, because you're a cancer survivor, did you have similar reactions? Are you having similar reactions to Tiffany? You're shaking your head.
Yeah, no,
not really?
Not at all. I think I might be considered more of a classic case in that the experience with cancer was not followed by a large drop-off into, kind of unhappiness and stress. It was more kind of what Dr. Constein said, about feeling more life, right? More of an investment in life, more of a drive to be happy. I can't hear about Tiffany's experience with cancer without a little bit of sadness because, sounds strange, of course I'd be sad, but no, it's for a different reason. I'm nostalgic for that time. Because she was probably more herself than I had ever seen her. And I think that's probably most people who have always known her would say. She really glowed during that time. And I think that because she had that large rise to kind of a level of happiness that she hadn't experienced before, that led to the drop-off. So I would say she seems maybe less like a classic case of fighting through cancer and coming out with a new positive attitude. It was a different trajectory.
So Tiffany, you've just described for us the sense of after having all of this, this sort of positive relationship with the world related to your cancer. And the Cancer Dancer videos, by the way, are on our Facebook page and our Twitter feed if you want to take a look at them, if our listeners and viewers want to take a look at them. And these videos went viral, and now you're describing sort of a spiral down or a dropping off. You've described it as paralyzing depression on some days. What do you think this is? I think that some of us could just chalk this up to being a physical side effect of treatment, but as mm-hmm. Dr. Constein described, it's more complicated than that. What do you think is going on?
I think it is. There's a couple things going on. One is, I had such a euphoric, high, amazing experience that kind of went, it's like I liken it to having like your own party that's celebrating you every day, and then the party's over, and you have that crash after the party. Anybody who's like thrown a wedding, and then the wedding's over. You know, it's just that kind of like, ugh, afterwards. You know, now what? And then on top of that, I really do feel that I'm having some physical manifestations, physical experiences that are a result of possibly the chemotherapy affecting my body, perhaps depleting certain systems in my body to the point where, you know, if my body's not working properly, not getting enough nutrients, maybe my liver's not detoxing as much as it should, how is that affecting my mind? You know, and is that contributing to a sadness and a sense of loss and despondency? So I think it's a couple different things. So I've been working actively to try a number of different things to pull me out of it.
All right. You're listening to and watching Second Opinion live right now on WXXI, on WXXI.org, on secondopinion-tv.org. We have Tiffany Staropoli and Rick Staropoli in studio with us. If you'd like to ask a question or make a comment, give us a call at 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. You can also tweet your questions to the hashtag 2NDOP. Also in studio with us today is Dr. Louis Constein from University of Rochester Medical Center. Dr. Constein, among other other responsibilities. He runs a survivorship care program at University of Rochester Medical Center. We're going to take a short break and come back to talk with our panel. More right after this. You're listening to Connections on WXXI. Welcome back to Healthy Friday Connections, Second Opinion Live. We are talking about health topics today on Connections, and we're happy to have you along with us. We're talking about life after cancer, and the reason why we picked up this topic today is because on Monday night on public television on WXXI-TV, Ken Burns is going to premiere a new three-part documentary series called Cancer, The Emperor of All Maladies. It's a documentary series based on the book of the same name, and that book talks about mostly the history of cancer. It starts at 9 o'clock on Monday night. So today in studio with us, we have Tiffany and Rick Staropoli, two cancer survivors. We have Dr. Louis Constein from University of Rochester Medical Center. He also runs a survivorship program at University of Rochester Medical Center, and he's a professor of oncology there. And we are talking today about life after cancer. Now, in the film, one of the principal themes of the film, The Emperor of All Maladies, which is going to be on TV on Monday night, is how cancer is received in our culture, the notion of bringing it from a very dark place to a place in the public spotlight. Tiffany, you talked a little bit about that, about how you actually brought media, brought your own sensibilities and your positive experience to cancer. This is happening in the media somewhat now, too. The television series Parenthood has a character who's struggling with breast cancer. Laura Linney was in Showtime's The Big C. And, of course, on AMC's Breaking Bad, we even saw Bryan Cranston play a character who had cancer and, of course, turned to a life of crime after getting the cancer diagnosis. I wonder, let's start with Dr. Constein, what are these media images of people with cancer do? What do they do or don't do for people who are facing actual diagnosis and treatment?
I'm trying to understand your question. Certainly, decades ago, patients with cancer were sort of shut away in closets, in mm-hmm. particular children. It was not considered a curable disease, and it was uncomfortable to watch people suffer. And for lots of different reasons, I think that it was an embarrassment for a patient to have cancer and frightening for anybody around that patient. And so those patients were rather closeted. What we've seen happen over the decades is a concerted attempt to understand what cancer is, to unravel its mysteries, to determine ways to treat it, to understand the side effects of the treatment. In the past 5 years, we've learned more about the molecular etiology of cancer, I think, than we did in the previous 25 years. So tremendous amounts of progress. What we've seen in newspapers, even much less medical journals in the past decade, is advertisement about this war that we are waging against cancer, even though Tiffany properly described it differently. And I think it is best not to think of it as a war. You talked about how it was something within you that you accepted and tried to understand and realize that you did need to conquer. But suffice it to say that the public media has thought about it as a war. Nixon declared war on cancer decades ago. We've talked about overcoming it, and now we are faced with the understanding that patients treated for cancer are often usually cured, and that they have a spectrum of needs that must be met. And that's our responsibility.
And one of the things that will come out in the documentary series is the incredible adaptability of cancer itself, that over the years it has been able to adapt. So maybe it is a war that we haven't won yet, but it was interesting to me, Tiffany, to hear your sort of representation of it as something that came from your body.
Yeah.
Therefore, it can't be all bad, let's say.
Yeah. It surprises me that nobody really, I mean, I can't say nobody. There are a lot of people out there like who approach it similar to myself, but this is something that started in our bodies, and it just seems so counterintuitive to me to want to wage war on yourself, to, you know, want to hate something about yourself, you know, I mean... You know, it's helpful to have kind of like a loving acceptance.
So, Dr. Constein, we should sort of say, I think, what are some of the different aspects of cancer that can affect the patient even after it's over? I mean, we know they're physical, we know they're psychosocial, we know they're emotional, but what are some of the things that are the most typical, most common?
Well, you've just named several important categories. The physical effects of cancer and its therapy really can involve any of the systems of the body. And it depends on the cancer, and it depends on the specifics of the chemotherapy, the specific agents or drugs that were used, and whether radiation was used, and if radiation was used, how much and to what part of the body. And so it's a broad field, and the heart, the lungs, the kidney, the liver, the ovaries or testes, the bowel, every organ in the body can be affected. For children, which is one of my specialties, though children are developing and they are at risk for these side effects for decades, and everybody treated for cancer is vulnerable to developing another cancer. And we think that that's a very complicated issue, but to some degree, if your body allow one cancer to grow, you are at risk for other cancers. And that's perhaps the most devastating side effect or outcome. And we call that the agony of victory for a patient to survive and live long enough to develop yet another cancer. You might say, well, why even be treated for the first cancer if you're just going to develop another one? But in fact, that risk is reasonably small, and we should be able to cure cancers that are subsequent to the initial cancer.
All right, Dr. Constein, you're using the word cure. Rick, you talked about being in your sixth year. And we even now when we talk about Rick having cancer and Tiffany having cancer, you're describing your experience as much simpler. But,
yeah.
But do you have fears of recurrence?
I don't carry them with me every day. Yeah, they're clearly in the back of my mind. There is a fear of recurrence. I know that I'm at greater risk. I don't know specifics because I've chosen not to look them up and read about them. I probably could. Interestingly, this is not off topic, but it's something you don't even know about. One of the best side effects of my cancer is that I've lived with MS since 2004, and the chemotherapy was a gift to me because it was a 2-for-1 deal. It got rid of my Hodgkin's lymphoma and also essentially put my MS into what you might call a remission. So for 5 straight years, I had no MS symptoms and no MS drugs. So I still look back on it as a gift. And also, yeah, I just choose not to live with that fear. I choose not to kind of hang out in that space, you know.
All right. Dr. Constein, there are other things that people go through, anxiety, sexual dysfunction sometimes. Mm-hmm. How do you deal with patients, and how does the survivorship program function alongside the medical community?
Well, you know, you've just brought up some of the primary complaints of patients treated for cancer: fatigue, anxiety, and depression, an absence of joy in sexual functioning. I mean, these are some of the big complaints that people have. And we need to confront these rather than try to avoid them or close our eyes to them. What we try to do in our Cancer Center program is first we try to meet with all patients. Members of their cancer team meet with patients subsequent to their primary treatment. So most patients are treated with chemotherapy, perhaps surgery, perhaps radiation. When that is completed, then members of the team will meet with them to review their treatment summary, how they were treated. And that information is given to them in electronic and written form and also sent to their providers. In addition, we discuss with them what kinds of risks they might have for the recurrence of their cancer and for side effects from the treatment, and outline what possible surveillance should be done. Should you have a sound wave test of your heart every so often? Rick and I were talking about this before the program. And again, all of these recommendations should be communicated to their private physician. Now, in terms of resources for some of what we've just discussed, anxiety, problems with your insurance, problems with your job, problems with sexual functioning, concerns about your fertility. So there are people who devote their lives to dealing with these particular issues, and we have resources available that, and we direct patients to the appropriate person for confronting these particular issues.
So is this what you call the survivorship care plan? Is this what they're making?
So the care plan,
or is it a summary of what happened?
The care plan was the second part of what I discussed. The treatment summary describes the treatment. The care plan outlines what we would recommend as appropriate surveillance over the next years of their lives in terms of what tests might be done and how often, depending on the specifics of the cancer and its treatment. And that would be the care plan. And then accompanying the care plan would be a list of possible resources that would be of interest to different patients. Could be nutrition, it could be exercise, it could be sexual functioning or fertility or all of the problems that we've just discussed. That's really a component of the care plan. So we meet with the patients after their primary therapy, but then we meet with them again when they are not being seen anymore by their treating oncologist for what we call active surveillance. When they are being discharged from care by their oncologist, then their own doctor needs to now take up the responsibility of doing whatever tests might be appropriate.
All right, let me tell our listeners and viewers, you can give us a call at 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255 if you'd like to talk to Dr. Constein or Tiffany or Rick Staropoli. We're talking about living with cancer. And I want to sort of piggyback right on to Dr. Constein's comment. Tiffany, is this a time when your treatment's over with and you're thinking about being a survivor? Is this the time you want to start getting even in better touch with your medical team and your group of physicians? I mean, do most people just say, I want to get as far away from the medical community as possible? And is that wise, do you think?
Well, no, it's not wise. It actually brought to mind, when I was told, you know, that I was officially in remission, I remember my meeting with my doctor, and I love him, and my oncologist, and, you know, I love being in that cancer center. I enjoy being around those people. But when I was told I was in remission, I could not have gotten out of that office faster. It was like, thank you so much. I'm out of here. Right. You know, I was done. I just wanted out. And I think a lot of people might feel that way. I think there's also, I'm on a number of message boards or, you know, Facebook groups for people with colorectal cancer, cancer survivors. And there are some people who actually go through all of it and then don't go back for their checkups. I mean, that actually happened. I couldn't imagine doing that, you know, because to me, you know, I want to know. I want to stay on it. As much as But every time you go in for a scan, you do have anxiety. We call it scanxiety. It's off-putting. A couple weeks prior, you start thinking about what if. What if it comes back with another positive diagnosis? What do I do? So, no, I don't think it's not wise to separate yourself from that. But I can understand the instinct.
What currently is your medical life like, besides going back for scans, in terms of having to keep an eye on the cancer and have various medications, whatever the needs are? What's your medical life like now?
I'm not on any pharmaceutical medications at all. I go in for a checkup with my oncologist every 4 months. I do like CT scans maybe every 6 months. I do a colonoscopy every year. And my surgeon, I meet with him every 6 months or 8 months or so. So yeah, and that'll happen, like, you know, for a number of years, and then, you know, after a couple of years, you start seeing them a little less, and by the 5 year mark, they should be able to say, oh, you're good to go. Thanks, you're a survivor.
Okay.
Have a nice life.
So you have videos, you have a particular approach that you've taken public, you have blogs, you guys are on a radio show and mm-hmm. a webcast today. How do you identify yourselves right now? Cancer survivors, regular
yeah.
people? How do you?
Well,
how do you...
certainly I would say that I'm a cancer survivor because it's the easiest way for someone to understand what I've been through. Even though I don't like the war metaphors, and I think survivor kind of like, you know, denotes war in a way. But it's just, if I'm talking to somebody, everybody knows what that means. I'm a cancer survivor. Oh, me too, you know.
And I'm Rick.
Well, you do. Yeah. Good point. We do see two very different different approaches here. Dr. Constein, how do you see people, typically, how do you think that they deal with this? Are people assuming more these days that they're going to survive when they start a treatment plan, or is it just as scary for people and there is just that sense of it's over, or I'm so hopeful it's over when
well,
the treatment's
you know,
over?
Well, it's impossible to talk about broad populations.
There's
nothing
that's
typical. Rick and Tiffany here who have just described the two ends of the spectrum, and I think for each person, when cancer affects them, it doesn't matter what they've heard about from others. They have their own reaction, and it's terrifying, I think, at least at the beginning. And what our hope is that we can be with each patient on that journey and de-terrify it, effectively treat it. But, of course, we don't always succeed, and that's devastating for everybody involved, not just the patient but also the caretakers. Hopefully, we have the luxury of being able to accompany people through the subsequent years of their lives because they have survived. And the program we have at our university, which was really made possible by generous people in the Rochester community, Richard DiMarzo, after his the program's named after his wife. I mean, it's the generosity of the people in this community and a large group of really dedicated people that make this program possible. That I have to give all the credit to, but our job is to sort of spread the word, so to speak. But more than spread the word, take the responsibility to do whatever we can to enhance the quality of lives of people like Tiffany and like Rick who have been treated for cancer. And but the reaction of the individual is something that it's our obligation to understand the individual. It's hard to talk about populations of people.
And it's got to be hard, though, as an oncologist to understand the individual, even though you have a lot of individual patients. Mm-hmm. And you've got a lot of other work to do. How do you, do you find physicians sometimes have trouble kind of approaching the living cancer part, the life after cancer part, the things that people are going on with people after the treatment's over with?
I don't think so. I think each physician does, I said for each physician, each patient is an inspiration. I think that for all of us taking care of, I think we feel privileged to care for patients with cancer and to do whatever we can do to understand the patient. Every patient has their own individual story, and for me, I've been doing this for 35 years. I love every day of my life and my work, and really taking care of patients is the most enriching part of my job. And I think that's true for most physicians. We try to understand our patients, and we care about them. And in fact, we fall in love with them. It's not just a job, really, to me.
Rick?
And I just wanted to add, first of all, the work that you do at Wilmot, but also the work that, you know, we had the benefit of receiving, the care we received at Lipson Cancer Center. Rochester is very blessed, and also I specifically to the point of kind of the doctors getting to know, the oncologists getting to know their patients, it's pretty amazing the extent to which we felt personally cared for by Dr. Kramer and all of the nurses. And the extent to which nobody could have seen the side effects, Tiffany's sort of after effects coming, because it wasn't for lack of them, being aware of us as patients, that I think there was a bit of a that there were after effects.
Yeah. All right. Our phone number is 844-295-TALK. You can call us. We have a few minutes left in our program today. This is Second Opinion Live. If you're just joining us and you're listening to us on the radio or watching us on secondopinion-tv.org, our program is sponsored by the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association, and we appreciate their support. They help us bring you valuable, accurate, and timely health information. And we're talking today about life after cancer in advance of the new PBS Ken Burns film that is starting on WXXI television on Monday night at 9 o'clock. It's called Cancer, the Emperor of All Maladies, and that's based on a book by the same name. And in that book, it really chronicles the history of cancer. There's also some very uplifting stories in the film about survivorship and about stories from people living with cancer. In New York City, they're engaging in a project with PBS about cancer survivors. There's a woman that worked with the radio station there who has survived ovarian cancer for the last 15 years, which is a long time that she's been followed. She considers herself to be a survivor. And she says that everything that she used to do in her life has been limited to being a patient. In other words, she's very happy that she survived and she's thrilled and celebrating life, but her entire life is sort of ensconced in this idea of being a patient, doing something related to cancer. So I want to ask Tiffany Staropoli, since you have been really public about your experience with cancer, is that how you feel?
That I'm like, wait, like I'm just now I'm becoming cancer girl.
That you're and that, defined like, now as being I'm defined a patient, yes.
Yeah, you know, I've thought about this, and this is part of my, what do I want to do with my life? What's my calling? Is my career, my chosen career, something I want to do for the rest of my life? Or is this, you know, something I want to commit myself to? Because, and I opened up my blog to more than just cancer. I decided deliberately that I don't want to talk about just that. I want to talk about other issues that people live with on a day-to-day basis that they may handle the same way somebody battles cancer. You know, they may battle divorce or addiction or other kind of things like that. So, I don't want to completely define myself by cancer, but at the same time, cancer was a catalyst to bring me to be a fuller, more whole person and to bring me out of this kind of cocoon I had created for myself. So why not ride it out? You know, I'm not going to fight that either. So,
all right, Dr. Constein, it seems like we've maybe in the past characterized, especially the media characterized cancer stories in a couple of ways, fight it and beat it or die. Submit to it. And it seems like maybe Tiffany and Rick are finding a different kind of ground. Do you see that here? And do you see that in patients that you have?
Yes, I do. And our lives are so much more complicated than just fight a battle and win it and then forget about it. And or I'm not trying to remember what you said about Rick, but I think that the concept that we now have is that cancer is a disease, that people are affected by this disease. For some people, it's actually a chronic disease. For others, it's something that can be cured, but with possible consequences of that cure. And so it is a lifelong problem that must not be ignored. One should not close their eyes to the potential ramifications of the treatment or of the cancer. And so I hear what you said about this young lady in New York who's defined herself as now living a life that is in one way or another embraced by the word cancer. And I don't think one needs to do that. I think it's a matter of how you define yourself. And optimistically, you will define yourself as now having an opportunity to live the fullest possible life you can with whatever time you have available. I think that's true for all of us, whether we've had cancer or not. But I think people treated for cancer, affected by cancer, really do have an understanding that isn't that easy for some of the rest of us to achieve, that life truly is precious, that you don't take it for granted, that you do appreciate each day, and something we can all learn from them. The question is, are they able to learn those lessons and not be overcome by some of the adverse problems created by the cancer and created by its treatment. So what a difficult balance that must be. And that's what I'm hearing in Tiffany's words. Rick's been pretty remarkable in his ability to come to terms with this disease, and he's even pointed out to us a benefit of his treatment, which is one of the few times I've heard that.
Dr. Lewis Constein, thank you so much for your time today at University of Rochester Medical Center. We have about a minute left, and so I want to thank Tiffany and Rick Staropoli for coming into the studio today to be with us. To use up our last minute or so, where are you in your journey right now, each of you? And since we're hopeful and we're positive and we're going to talk about the future, what do you think is next?
I'm just going to give a very brief message out to everybody. The concept of live like you are dying that I think Dr. Constein was talking about, the problem I have with that song is it says, I hope you get the chance to live like... No, take the chance. Anyone, you don't need to wait for a diagnosis to live that way.
Yeah. And for me, I am on a journey. I am on a journey that is changing every day. You know, I've got some up days, I've got some down days, and I'm working to... make the best of every day as much as I can, despite what, these kind of physical or mental ramifications of the fallout after cancer. You know, it's just, but isn't that everybody's job, just to make the best out of every day?
All right. Thank you very much for your time and your presence here today. We really appreciate it. That's all the time we have for Second Opinion Live. We hope you enjoyed the program. If you want to listen to it again or you'd like to share it with someone, it will be a podcast on secondopinion-tv.org. You can also tweet questions to 2NDOP, that hashtag, if you have additional commentary there. I'm Elisa Orlando. Thank you so much for joining us today. Our technical director for the program is John Andres, and our sponsor, and a special thanks to the sponsor of Second Opinion, Blue Cross Blue Shield Association. Their support helps make Second Opinion Live possible. And to the co-producer of Second Opinion, the University of Rochester Medical Center. We'll see you next month for another edition of Second Opinion Live. And Science Friday comes your way next.